Welcome to episode 120 of the Omni Gamers Club podcast, the podcast for games on all platforms, including Triple Triad. I am Daniel Winter.
Hello, Daniel, and I am Mark Uessa, and we are very happy to be joined, I think maybe for the third week in a row, by a guest, a different guest, but this time a return guest once more. It is Alex from Meeple and the Moose. Welcome back, Alex. How you doing?
I'm well. Thanks for having me.
Of course, you're always welcome on the Omni Gamers Club. You're one of our members. I hope you are okay with that.
Absolutely.
Awesome.
Frequent listeners will remember you joined us for our review of Duel for Middle Earth, I think it was, last year.
That's right. And actually, I just saw that they are announced an expansion for that game, so I'm looking forward to that too.
I missed that. Excellent. I'll take a look. Yeah, but I've been following your blog, obviously, Meeple and the Moose, who have written reviews of board games mostly, but I was interested to see that you'd started posting some reviews of Final Fantasy, specifically all the Final Fantasies. So I knew at some point we had to get you on to talk about that. It's taken a little bit of time for us to get everything in a row and for us to play the games ourselves. So we'll be definitely beginning into that and hearing a little more about your project in our main course. But first, we'll have a bit of an appetizer talking about some other game-related news. Did you want to start us off, Alex?
Sure. The appetizer I want to bring to your podcast is the Game Makers board game that just finished up on crowdfunding last week. So the Game Makers is published by Bezier and designed by Ben Rossett. And if you've been paying attention to the board game world, Ben has also designed, I think it was last year's or earlier this year's fairly hot game Fromage and Between Two Castles of the Mad King Ludwig. And what makes the Game Maker stand out is that it's a game about making games, and Bezier has licensed the art assets from hundreds of games from across all kinds of publishers. Like if you flip over a card, you'll probably find one of your favorite games represented in this game. And so because it was also available on Board Game Arena at the same time as crowdfunding, I had a chance to give it a go, and you know, it was a pretty good experience. Like the game itself was pretty good. The way you play is that there's this rondelle on the center of the table with the six wedges. And each turn, you take all of your forklifts that are in the first wedge and move them to the next up to three wedges away. And when you move your forklift, you get a resource. It could be card, could be paper, could be wood, you know, the things you need to make board games. And every time you take a resource, you need to choose to either keep the resource as something to use to build a game or something else that you can use to improve your factory. Like the cards you can either keep to put into cards for your game, or they are also your contracts. And the wood will either be wood components for your board game or workers for your factory. So every action that you're taking here has two uses and kind of pulls you in two different directions. And it was a fun game. Like the main turns was simultaneous, so it had a really good flow. But the theme was supposed to be a love letter to the board game hobby, but it really was. This is a board game manufacturing.
Like, this not is sort of co-published by Panda, the manufacturing company, basically.
Yeah, Panda has a pretty big presence in their crowdfunding campaign, like on the box, and like I think even in the crowdfunding, you can purchase like a 20-inch Panda Meeple as well. Like it's they partner pretty heavily with Panda, the board game manufacturer there.
I love a good sort of meta-textual commentary in the theme. I am a big fan of Bezier. I mean, Castles Mad King Ludwig, one of my top 10 games, although I've not played any of Ben's previous designs. So I'm, you know, tentatively curious in how this, like, approaches that topic. But on the other hand, I can't help but feel this whole endeavor is a bit cringe, just in how it's reducing board games down to commodification.
Yes,
and just every game is just, oh, look, I recognize that. Oh, I recognize that. And not really saying much interesting about it. Or saying that with a whole lot of plastic for the other thing.
Yes, you got that exactly right. It is less a love letter to the board game hobby, and much more of a homage to overconsumption. Like, this isn't the kind of game for the person who loves games, the person who's played, you know, Seven Wonders 100 times or, you know, has really dived deep into board games. But it feels like it's much more for that type of board gamer who has a dozen unplayed games on their shelves and have 15 unfulfilled Kickstarters on their backlog.
I haven't played the game, so I will reserve my judgment on the game itself. I'm sure there's some interesting mechanisms there. All the right people are involved, so you know what could be wrong there. But you know, the whole like self-referential nature of it is kind of like we've reached the postmodern era of the board game hobby. You know, this is like Ready Player One or Infinity War, Infinity Gauntlet territory, where we're just pulling every reference in together.
Smashing the action figures together.
Yeah, exactly. To please the Uber fans that are more fans of like the industry than they are of maybe individual games. But, you know, Bezier, like they do produce like small, cute games too. Like they produce a lot of the, like, they do like the One Night Vampire or One Night Werewolf and that sort of stuff too.
Cat in the Box, Shrivel Princess.
Yeah, so it's not like they're known for excessive productions like Simon or something like that. So, you know, maybe there is a solid game there. I have long ago shied away from the excesses of, hopefully, overconsumption of board games. I'm a little bit out of touch, actually.
And Kickstarter specifically, because this is playing to a lot of those FOMO tactics of like, a lot of those games featured are like locked behind Kickstarter exclusives, basically.
Yeah.
For sure. Well, I guess it's a commentary on where we are one way or another.
Yeah, meta all the way down there. Excellent. Well, I'll jump over to my appetizer, and then I want to talk a little bit more about Game Pass. We've recently talked about how we've basically dropped that service, but it seems like it's only further become intensified in the time since we've just had like hot off, you know, price increases on the Xbox consoles and most other consoles for what it's worth. Game Pass just announced that they've increased prices by 150% for the top tier Ultimate, and prices are up across the board basically. So I mean, most of these subscription services, you know, it's pretty much a given that you're going to be paying a little bit more every year. Microsoft seemed to have forgotten, or at least stopped caring about the whole, you know, boiling the frog slowly at this point, and just like they've just gone all in. Does smell a little bit of a little desperation in perhaps some of the other struggles they've been having over there. They have added a bunch of new games to the service for what it's worth. Ubisoft Plus has been added to it, Fortnite Crew, and some others, like, you know, a lot of indie games for what it's worth as well. But I'm sure that's not like a huge cost to them. It's just they're just trying to justify that they, you know, feel the need to increase the cost. These services are always a loss leader. They always start out the gate as losing money, and they're constantly trying to scrabble that back indefinitely. So I think they're trying to, they're feeling the pinch at this point.
Right. On balance, you're getting more, but you're paying a lot more for that more. Mm. Alex, did you partake of or make use of Xbox Game Pass or PlayStation Plus or anything like that?
Yeah, I used to do Humble Bundles when they did their Humble monthly choice, and I did that for like 5 or 6 years. And then one month I was just tired of Humble's offerings, and I subscribed to Game Pass, and I stopped doing Humble Choice. And so I did Game Pass for 4 or 5 years at that point. And when I lost my job in January, I canceled my Game Pass and realized, like, oh, hey, wait, I don't own any of the games I've been playing. Mm-hmm. And so when I got my next job, I just did not resubscribe because I like owning my products.
Fair. Actually, that's one of the pluses of the Humble Choice, which is still going on. They still do a monthly package, which I don't even know why they call it Choice anymore, because I think you get all the games on the list anyway. It's something like 8 or 9 games every month. It's sort of a random grab bag. And there's usually like 1 or 2 big-ish games that are recently put out, and a few more medium-sized games and a few more smaller games in the mix. So a nice smattering. But if you subscribe for a month and that month runs out, you get to keep the games that you bought as part of that bundle. So it's an interesting system and pretty good value. But Microsoft's offering here just, you know, like, is kind of a further nail in the coffin, I guess you could say. I mean, Daniel and I haven't been subscribers for since the boycott started, the BDS movement related to the Azure and used by the Israeli Defense Force. So we have that already, but this is just all around not looking great for Microsoft. I heard it referenced on an IGN podcast recently as like, this is the Vegas buffet of offerings. Like the PlayStation Plus in its original form, which I used to subscribe to when I was much more of a PlayStation user, was great. You know, you got like two games a month or something like that. And it was a very minimal cost. And they likened that to a value meal. It's cheap and cheerful. It's great. And this one is kind of like one of those like $80 Canadian buffets that you go to at Las Vegas, where you have to eat like a metric ton of crab to actually claw your money back. And it's a lot of stress. It's a lot of cost. And it doesn't really satisfy the vast majority of people. So, you know, who is this more expensive offering going to please? I don't know.
I mean, there are quality games on the service we've spoken about before. There's a bunch of like smaller indie games that I never would have taken a chance on and played only because it was on Game Pass. But I've become increasingly disillusioned with that and how it basically trains you to follow the path of least resistance and just eat whatever they put in front of you. And there's so many other experiences that I didn't experience because I was, you know, so blasé about just playing whatever happens to be on Game Pass. And at this point, I want to be much more intentional about not letting mega corporations like decide what I'm going to consume, basically. Don't let them control the algorithm. It really speaks to what not the failure of media, but what media can be offering and where they have room to improve. There are plenty of, you know, a lot of smaller podcasts and blogs out there advocating for smaller games that aren't getting the attention of bigger media groups and Game Pass. So I think it's worth looking off the beaten trail a little more, finding voices that you trust, and finding some more curated recommendations.
Right, like some of the big notable games, or like the, not big games, but more notable indie titles that have come out of Game Pass of late. You have your Hollow Knight Silk Songs, you have your Among Us, or what's the other one, Vampire Survivors, or things like that. Those are all cheap games anyways. Silk Song is cheaper than a month of Game Pass at the new price. Vampire Survivors and the other one that I mentioned are like a couple of bucks. So, you know, if you even follow video game industry a little bit, you will hear buzz if you listen to podcasts like this. Hopefully you'll get some recommendations of good indie titles to follow. Or, you know, we talked about Vancouver Game Garden the other day, which is a great way to kind of tie into your local indie game circle. So there's lots of ways to tap into indie games if that's your thing. Even the aforementioned Humble Choice. Like, Humble is also a publisher of a lot of those games. They actually brought a lot of those Humble published games to Game Pass too, so you can still get those. But you don't have to suckle at the teat of big Microsoft to get it that way either. So, yeah, I don't think I'm going to go back to Game Pass anytime soon.
Yeah, I mean, at this point, I've now dropped every streaming platform. Games and you know, Netflix and Disney alike. I don't have any. I'm not paying for any of those anymore. I'm going to be much more selective about what I watch and play at this point. So yeah, it's a new era for cable cutters.
You know, it's a great choice for media providers that is very low cost is the local library system. If you're fortunate enough to have a pretty strong local library system, you know, we're all Canadian here. But Alex, are you local in the Lower Mainland area as well?
I'm in Victoria. I'm on the island.
Okay, there you go. I'm sure there's a good library system on the island.
Yeah.
Vancouver's and BC's are both quite good. BC, you know, includes the North Van Library, which you go to. Daniel, they include video games. And I think, like, I'm just about almost beaten Metaphor ReFantazio at 85 plus hours in, all from borrowing from the library. So if you're fortunate enough to have a good library system, that's a great way to play games too.
Absolutely.
Okay. I think we talked at length about Game Pass. I'm just going to put a big, very short little announcement out, because I actually don't know that much about it. They're making a Phantasy Star dun-dun-dun TTRPG tabletop role-playing game system based in the 80s sci-fi console RPG universe that Daniel and I have been playing of late. I've really loved Phantasy Star since I was a little wee Sega kid on the Master System and the Sega Genesis. And this game, the big kind of like bummer about it is it's 5e based. So it's by, I forget the name of the publisher, but I believe they're connected to another sci-fi 5e conversion called, I think it's called Esper Genesis, which I actually bought the PDFs for. It's actually pretty solid. Like, it seems like it's good stuff. It's just, you know, kind of a bit tethered to the D&D style rules. But if you like them and you like sci-fi, then this will be a very easy transition. Hopefully they do a good job of translating that into the Phantasy Star universe.
Yeah, it definitely won't be the last time I'm talking about Phantasy Star today, but I'm curious. I don't have a lot of interest in IP role-playing games. I'd like to see those games explore new areas where they don't sort of beholden and tied down by lore and setting. But yeah, I'm curious to see how they adapt that that game series.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's nice to see any old Phantasy Star stuff come out. Obviously, Phantasy Star Online has been a much bigger phenomenon than any of the old single-player RPGs were. So that's always been a shame in my mind. I prefer the old sci-fi, science fantasy games of that series. So this is nice to see. Maybe it'll bring a bit of buzz back. Maybe there'll be even a single-player Phantasy Star video game coming out in the future. Who knows? One can hope.
Just the thought that you're not a fan of IP-based TTRPGs, coming from the perspective of someone who has not played any TTRPGs, I would be much more inclined to play a role-playing game with a theme that I already adore. Like, I saw Root had a role-playing game come out, and I was more interested to try that than almost any other than I'd seen before.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely can be intimidating to, like, go into a new universe and feel like you have to learn that. At the same time, I think a good GM can bring you into that world and not just turn into, ooh, I recognize that. But some of those games settings are designed to be playgrounds and explore. And yeah, I don't know a lot about the setting of Phantasy Star, but I mean, it's lots of planets to visit there, I'm guessing.
Yeah, and a lot of TTRPG systems are kind of like almost IP-like, like the Scum and Villainy game that Daniel and I covered is pretty much Star Wars. And
with the serial numbers filed off, and you can basically make it Star Wars if you want, but you don't have to be beholden to the rules of Star Wars, right?
So you give and take the good stuff or the bad. Anyhow, I think we've teased our topic a couple times already, so I think we should dive into the main course. What do you guys think?
Yeah, so I mean, why don't we start with you, Alex? And I wanted to hear a little bit more about this Final Fantasy project of yours.
Yeah, so on my blog, I've started this Final Fantasy project. And this was kind of inspired by you, Mark, when you started talking about all of your Retroid handhelds. I picked up a Retroid Pocket 4, and after 3.5 days of tinkering and modding and trying all the different front ends and getting all the emulators exactly how I wanted it, I sat down and I was like, oh no, what do I play? I have endless numbers of ROMs, but I don't know how to choose what I actually want to play. And so I had always been a fan of the Final Fantasy series, and I realized that this Retroid could play up to from FF1 to 12. I was like, hey, I've played almost all of them. I've beaten almost none of them. Let's start from the beginning and beat them all. So it was early this year I started playing Final Fantasy 1, and I've been chronicling my thoughts on the series on my blog as I've beaten each title, which I'm now on to Final Fantasy 8.
Mm-hmm. So you've currently published reviews for the first 7 games.
That's right.
And so you're only reviewing the mainline, like, numbered titles? Are you going to, do you plan to sort of branch out perhaps and explore some of the other sideline games?
Well, I do have a couple sideline games that I really adore. Like, I really love Final Fantasy Tactics Advanced and Tactics A2, which I did play late last year when I first tried soft modding my 3DS. And I've just picked up Final Fantasy Theatrium. I can't pronounce that damn word.
Yep. Theatrhythm.
Yeah, it's like theater rhythm and mash those two words together. But it's a rhythm-based game with all the Final Fantasy music, and it's been really fun. So I think once I catch up to the mainline series, then I will start picking off some of the spin-offs that I remember quite fondly, like the Crystal Chronicles series. I would love to give that a fair shot. Mm.
Yeah, that's a very ambitious project, but you know, kudos to you. I think a lot of people, myself included, are kind of in that same boat. I mean, if you're of a certain age and you have an interest in JRPGs, you probably have tried a hand at some of the Final Fantasies. And It's kind of an interesting phenomenon because, like, the newer ones have kind of lost their way a little bit. I mean, 15 was kind of in this kind of arduous place. It had to be remade kind of from the ground up at one point into an entirely different game. And the game that actually did get delivered, people were a little mixed on their reactions to that game. 16, the more recent one, is not a turn-based RPG at all, apparently, and suffered from some weak sales because I think it was exclusive to the PlayStation 5, if I'm not mistaken. So that limited its access. 14 was an MMO. 11 was an MMO. 12 was not terribly well regarded at the time. 13, a lot of people called as like a very linear experience. So, like, unless you were, you know, around or a younger person that are into the classics, you probably haven't played a big streak of Final Fantasy games. But the Final Fantasy is like lives large in gaming kind of lore, right?
Everyone's it is a heard monolith
of it. Yeah,
I mean, you do have to give it to them; they're very much willing to shake up the tropes in that game and not be stuck to a formula. Every game has been, at least the last, you know, the last half dozen entries have all been pretty different from each other.
Yeah, let's break it down then. Okay, so Alex, you said yourself you never really, you played a bit of the series, never finished a lot of them. I'm kind of in the same boat. I think everyone here has played one. I played, like, what did I play? So I played 1, 3, 4... Not 5 ever, because 5 didn't come to the West until fairly recently. 6 came in a weird way. 7, of course, I played the original, and I played the remake. I haven't finished either. 8, I played a bit. 9, I finished. 10, I didn't finish. 11, I played and enjoyed. 12, I finished. 13, not at all. 14, didn't really hook me. 15, I finished. 16, I haven't played. So about half, about half or a third of them I played. What about you, Daniel?
Yeah, so I, at some point in my 20s, I know I tried 7 just because it had so much, such a weight of nostalgia for it. I think I must have played it on an emulator. I couldn't get past, I just didn't have the patience for the turn-based combat at the time or the nostalgia for those chunky PlayStation 1 graphics. And so bounced off that pretty quickly. So the first one I played properly, funnily enough, was 13. Despite knowing all the issues people had with that, I mostly wanted to play it for the CG cutscenes that were like really stunning at the time. And funnily enough, like, I know everyone complained about that game being super linear. Like, I liked the momentum of that linear story, like, for the first 40 hours and then dropped off the moment it hit the open world and never finished that. I've since played, I've played 10 and 12, didn't finish those. You hit this sort of grindy point towards the end of most of these games. The only ones I've actually finished are 9 and 15. And like 9, I've only just played in the last year or two, and it really blew my mind in the sense of like, oh, if I was 14 and played this, it would have changed my world.
Yeah,
I kind of feel like 9 is like the platonic optimum Final Fantasy because it's kind of like in the middle. It's literally straddles both the old and the new. It's really high production value, really beautiful art direction. Colorful characters, it's got a bit of humor, it's got a bit of action, it's got a bit of drama. And
bit of existentialism.
epic fantasy, but like memeable moments too. So it's got a lot going for it. I guess none of them have really like just been universally loved, except for maybe 6 and 7. 6 and 7 are probably the most highly regarded in a universal sense. I think everyone has their favorite. But those are generally kind of like held at a high bar.
I mean, it is
4 as well.
It is surprising just how different everyone's sort of top lists for this series are. Like every game in the series is someone's favorite.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. So we've covered our kind of background CVs. Shall we circle it back to number one? And we're going to be talking about, are we essentially talking about the remake, all of us, or are we talking about different versions of one?
Well, I think we've all played a slightly different version.
Okay. I played the Dawn of Souls Game Boy Advance version. So not the original, but not the Pixel Remaster.
Yeah, I think the Pixel Remaster is actually borrows a lot from that GBA version. Obviously, there's been many versions of all of these games, but there's kind of like standards where they like, oh, that's a good point, or that's a good translation, or something like that. Okay, I played the original on the NES, NES, and probably a couple more, and then I recently finished the Pixel Remaster like last week.
I also played the Pixel Remaster, though I did play for an hour or two the original NES version and the Dawn of Souls version, just to compare what they're doing differently. I guess we should say just some numbers up front. So this is developed and published by Square, just Square, directed by Horonobu Sakaguchi, and originally released for the Nintendo Entertainment System on December 18th, 1987. And a little bit of trivia I was surprised by is that this predates the first Phantasy Star game by 2 days.
Yeah, narrowly being the earliest RPG we've covered, because we've talked about Phantasy Star 1.
The Pixel Remaster was released on July 28th, 2021, for what it's worth.
Yeah, the remaster is out on like lots of systems. It's out on pretty much every console, mobile, Android, Apple, whatever.
Yeah, well, looking at a list of like the different versions of this game, there's been like 20. And what a bunch of the changes that I thought were actually from that Dawn of Souls GBA version were apparently actually from like a console called like the Wonder Swan Color in Japan. Yeah. Like all those new sprites and like the detailed backgrounds were all from that version. But the first in the West, at least, was the Dawn of Souls.
Yeah, Bandai or Wonder Swan, right? Like the makers of, you know, like Bandai Namco of One Piece card game.
Alex, did you want to give us a bit of a rundown on what this game is?
Sure. So Final Fantasy is it's the classic JRPG. The story starts off with the four heroes of light, crystals in hand, and their task with saving the princess from the evil knight Garland. Once they do that, they set out to destroy the four elemental fiends to restore light to the crystals. And you as the player, control these four heroes as they adventure throughout the land and fight monsters and level up and earn magic and cast spells until they eventually fulfill their quest.
That's like a very good, very good succinct overview. So many like classic things established by this series, and early ones as well. I really like that mission to rescue the princess is kind of like the first like 30 minutes of the game.
It's like a little prequel, like a prologue almost.
Yeah, it's kind of like the Breath of the Wild like starter island or whatever.
Well, you don't actually see like the opening cutscene is like after that prologue, which is quite a really cinematic moment.
The title sequence. Yeah. It happens after you rescue the princess.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of the origins of this genre, I think Dragon Quest 1 and maybe 2 had already come out at this point. At least the first one of those was pretty much a solo character. You didn't have a party of characters, right?
That's correct. I
don't know if this is the first game to have had a party, but at the start of this game, the first thing you do is create four characters. You basically choose your four classes and name them at the get-go before you boot up the rest of the story.
Yeah, which is a departure from like even later Final Fantasies when you just kind of get started with like Tidus and whatever.
Named characters. Or even self-insert characters.
Right, but this one let you pick like four white mages if you wanted. Like that was pretty, I guess I wouldn't really say revolutionary, because we have to remember that these JRPGs, even at their infancy, are coming from somewhere. And they're coming from Western CRPGs, which were really getting popular at the time in the 1980s, even in Japan, on early, you know, home PCs.
Well, they're also coming from D&D pretty explicitly in a bunch of ways.
Although I would argue that most of those computer RPGs are coming from D&D as well, right? Even before that, you know, like Rogue and NetHack and, you know, like, computer engineers have always been super nerds, fantasy RPG nerds. So, but yeah, Wizardry, Ultima, we can't forget that those series were like uber popular in Japan for anyone who had access to a personal computer. And those games generally did let you choose your party loadout and customize your your party, just like you know, like Baldur's Gate 1 did, for instance.
I think one of the things that Final Fantasy 1 was a pioneer in was having that side view of battle, where you could see your party characters on the side, and like when they're stunned, when they're down, like they have that animation, like so that you feel for your characters.
Yeah, I agree with that. Like the Dragon Quest, I think doesn't even show your character in the first ones. It just shows the enemies, and then it just kind of like there's like a screen flash, and then that's the you're striking them with your sword.
And I think Phantasy Star just had the names in the grid.
Yeah, and then Phantasy Star 2 has like their backs. You just always see the characters' backs, which is kind of like awkward. Like you get to see their backs for a long part of the game. But yeah, I think the Final Fantasy series, strangely enough, the characters are on the right hand of the screen, and then the enemies are on the left. So I guess that kind of mirrored like the Japanese like reading direction, right? They read right to left.
Right,
so that made sense for them. But yeah, I think that was pretty revolutionary because you got to have both like lush monster art, which, you know, Dragon Quest had, but you got to have this cutesy character art, which is never quite as like high res as the monster art. For some reason, they went really all out on the monsters.
I was surprised how many of the monsters, like there's not many recognizable Final Fantasy tropes here. Mostly you're fighting goblins and wolves and scorpions, and they're fairly generic monsters. I think the only one that comes to mind is the Sahagin, I think it's called, like the sort of water lizard things.
I can see their web fingers.
Yeah, I guess you're right. Like kind of like unique Final Fantasy quote unquote monsters, like the what are they, like the Cactar?
There's no Moogles or
Chocobos.
Yeah
But you do have a few things, like you have Leviathan and Tiamat and things like
Bahamut.
I'd see Cid did get a name drop, though I believe that was added in one of the later versions.
Yes, that was added later.
Right, and I think they even have like Final Fantasy has weird traditions. I don't think it was in this one, but you have like Wedge and Biggs and things like that in earlier titles.
What you do have is crystals. I think the time till crystal is about 30 seconds in this game.
Yeah, so like faster than Final Fantasy IV, even for sure. Yeah, so lots of things are established in this, and like a lot of games from this time, a lot of the RPGs, of JRPGs, early JRPGs, are a lot about sort of like methods of transportation. Because like they're gating your progress, obviously, which is really smart. The intro mission, we're going to spoil the intro mission because it's the first half an hour of the game. But it's basically,
40 years old. I was going to say,
yeah, you're on this tiny island, and there's like the bridge is out, because of course the bridge is out. Like there's no bridge, so the castle town has not been trading with anyone recently. But the bridge is literally out, and not until you rescue the princess and you have the title scroll do a bunch of castle engineers come and magically restore the bridge. So that connects you to the rest of the world, and thus your adventure begins. And then they continue to gate you from accessing other parts of the world with things like vehicles. So I think you start off with like a canoe.
A ship, and then a canoe,
and then ultimately an airship. So airships are established right in this first one as well. Kind of cool to see right from the beginning of the series.
Yeah, I did quite like how that the world design was laid out. Like, this is an open world, but you can in theory go anywhere, but you're limited by those travel restrictions, basically. And I did find it quite organic the way they sort of blocked you off from certain areas, and you'd sort of loop back around and come in from the other direction. And that all felt very organic, and just the way you're blocked off there. And exploring the world wasn't particularly engaging. I did think that, like, you so often just come across dead ends that felt like it should have like a treasure chest or something there, and no, there's just nothing. There was like the one point I did really hit a wall in knowing where to go was when you had to find the airship, and you have to go to a random desert, and you find the airship in this empty desert, but only after you've got these other items. So I'd already been to this desert like twice trying to figure out where I was supposed to go. Like, oh, there's nothing there. Why would I go back to this desert?
It's kind of funny that airships coming out of deserts became a trope for the series going forward. But I guess in the first one it's not a trope yet, so you wouldn't know.
Yeah, I guess like this it was an early thing of JRPGs and maybe even CRPGs before it, but like basically you kind of wandered around until you found something. And you just wandered and kind of tried to eliminate, you know, the dead ends, essentially. Like a maze game. You know, these are simplistic times, you know, pretty primitive times in terms of this technology. And sort of primitive in terms of game design. Like, I am struck whenever I play these early RPGs, how much of the kind of early tricks they would use from adventure games. So graphical adventure games, text-based adventure games, like they're doling out these hints and you gain them by talking to the villagers, typically, or someone in a castle or someone that at the end of a dungeon or maybe like a witch or whatever in a little cavern or a shed somewhere out, a hut in the woods or something like that. Basically, you have to talk to everyone. Like, Daniel, I think you were sharing some artwork from the manual that said, you have to talk to everyone. Because you did back in these days.
And it did draw attention to the fact that what these NPCs will say changes after certain events. So I really struggled. I did talk to everyone, and I just didn't find the information I needed. Perhaps if I had gone back and talked to everyone a second time, then you find it, potentially. What I was really surprised, actually, in terms of, like, trying to think through, or what from this pixel remaster is new and what's from the original. The one thing I expected to be new was the dancer character, who's this character in the courtyard of the first town who basically gives you a clue where you should go next, at least for the first half of the game. But no, she was there from the get-go, so they did anticipate that being an issue, obviously.
Yeah.
Well, I think in some part of it, I wonder how much they expected you to crowdsource your information back in 1987. Like, when I was playing this, I felt like I really wished I had my buddies on the school play yard all playing this game too, and we could share this information. Like, I don't know where to go in here. Like, oh, I knew this one because I talked to that one NPC that one time.
Well, the thing is, like, a few people had suggested, oh, Nintendo Power. Everyone was just looking at Nintendo Power and getting the answers there. But I looked up the original manual. The Western, like, US version of the manual was 90 pages and was basically a walkthrough for, like, two-thirds of the game and told you exactly where to go. Like, the first, like, 30 seconds of the game, getting to where you talk to the king and get your quest, was like 4 pages. And, like, really, like, oh, this is how you go upstairs. This is how you go through doors. This is how you talk to every NPC in the game. Don't walk past that NPC. Talk to them. And, yeah, it was really robust in walking you through that. It told you exactly where the airship was.
I don't know if you guys lived through this time or, you know, had, you know, whatever, pocket money to buy RPGs at this time. I certainly recall, and I remember how big of a hurdle it was to get RPGs into mainstream console audiences. Now, obviously, you know, computer owners had access to lots of RPGs, like, you know, the aforementioned Wizardry and things like that, and the Western counterparts, Ultima. But consoles, it was sort of like the final frontier. And they said, it would never take off. Even though this Dragon Quest, eventually Dragon Warrior in North America, Dragon Quest was a million seller or more in Japan many years over. This was, you know, bankable property. It was a really hard sell.
After they gave away, like, thousands of copies, right?
That's right. They had to give it away with Nintendo Power subscriptions because basically the retailers or the publisher didn't have any faith that this would sell, appeal to the West. Ironic, since fantasy is obviously very popular in the West. Fantasy RPGs were invented in the West. I think it was maybe a little bit of Japanese people thinking Westerners were dumb.
Well, it's also the sense that, like, so many of these games feel like they're made by Japanese studios, but they're drawing on Western mythology in a lot of cases. And so for Americans, it's not as much exoticism. Like, it's just a generic medieval fantasy world to us.
Yeah, possibly. And, I mean, maybe to their credit, maybe they just didn't have the localization resources. And most of these games, let's be honest, had tons of writing. Way, way, way larger scripts than any, you know, jump on top of the ninja sort of game that was the typical fare that was coming out on the NES at that point. Mm.
For what it's worth, growing up in Australia, this game did not get released until like 2004 or something. I think it was like it did not get a PAL release. That's Europe and Australia. This is only in North America.
Right. So depending on where you are in the world, you're coming to Final Fantasy at various different times, which I guess sort of makes sense why there were so many different releases and versions on different Nintendo and Bandai hardware, like we mentioned. So Final Fantasy 1 is pretty faithful. I kind of established those original JRPG tropes. You're scouring the world, going into dungeons, going into caves, talking to NPCs. And I actually thought there was a lot of fanciful scenarios that came up, kind of touching upon that adventure game analogy I made. Like, basically, you have to get the MacGuffin in every chapter, right?
A lot of fetch quests and set pieces without much necessarily story or character.
Yeah.
Well, I thought the scenarios were pretty, like, fantastical, you know? Like, you're talking to witches and giants, and you're finding, you know, caravans in the desert, and you're finding magical flutes and keys and going into, you know, like bandit camps and things like that. Like, conceptually, these are quite fantastical and probably a little bit more literary, I suppose, than anything you're doing in a Mario game. You know, you're just in like swamp land, or you're in forest land, or you're in starry land in those games, right? So I think they're doing some things a pretty kind of primitive by this day and age, compared to newer JRPGs.
I mean, compared to newer JRPGs, they leave a lot to your imagination, or they rely on your imagination to fill in a lot of the blanks. Like, what was that final walkway to Bahamut or Leviathan? Whatever the boss was in that, like, that sky tower. Like, I was thinking, because I was using an emulator, so I had save states, but, like, after getting through that entire dungeon, walking on that final stretch, like, knowing I'm going to hit a boss, and, like, will I be able to beat the boss, or will I get my ass kicked back to the start? And, like, having that, like, feeling of terror, and, like, having my imagination fill in all those gaps. I think that's a pretty important aspect to these old games.
Well, I think to me, part of the main friction, like, that's one of the main draws in this, was that sense of preparation. How far can you push your party? Look, this isn't a particularly deep game in terms of its tactics and combat that we'll perhaps get to, but like, you start out like, oh, I can only fight a couple of a couple of battles before I have to go back to town and heal up. But you gradually get you level up a little bit, you can push out a little bit further, and there's a constant tension of how far can you push yourself, can you get to the dungeon, can you get to the boss before you have to come back. And something I think is perhaps lost in these new editions is that there was these items called the tents and the cabin and house, I think, that they will give you health, but only in the overworld, not in the dungeon. But reading through the manual, what I didn't realize is those were save points. Like, usually you can only save in the town. I mean, obviously on a modern console, you can save whenever you want. But on the NES, if mum says dinner's ready, you have to use your tent, set up in the overworld, and that's the only way to save the game.
In Dragon Quest 1, you could only save in one location in the world.
Well,
there were like multiple continents, but you could only save in the starting castle. Yeah, definitely in the modern era, they've added a lot of quality of life improvements. Mm. Some would say improvements. I mean, I would say that they are improvements because most of them are optional. So the primary ones are the ones you mentioned. So save states in some cases, you know, for instance, a lot of the Nintendo Switch Online, Nintendo Classic games have save states built in, no matter what the genre is. Definitely the saving in the Pixel Remaster was quite liberal. You could have save anywhere out in the world. You could save any time in a town, and you could save one quick save in a dungeon. So that was really nice. And then they added fast forward and auto attack, but the auto attack was very, very limited. Basically, all it did was repeat the previous command that you chose. So it wasn't intelligent at all. It was just kind of like a spam attack button. Alex, did the one that you played have fast forwarding battles or any of those niceties?
No, it did not natively. The Dawn of Souls remake did not have those natively, but the emulators did. So I was able to map mash A button to the right trigger and you know, fast forward to the right thumbstick. So when I'm fighting mobs in the world, just trying to get to and from a town, I can fast forward and hold the R button. It will auto attack. So I'm not using my MP for anything, right?
Yeah, for sure. That's how I got through Phantasy Star 1, for sure, with my sanity intact. It makes a big difference.
I was a little surprised playing those old editions, though. Like, the original NES version was a lot harder, for one thing. Like, the monsters feel like they hit harder, but it was actually like 5 or 6 battles before I even leveled up for the first time. Whereas the Dawn of Souls version, you can basically mash your way through the first fight and you level up after the first fight. So you're making progress very quickly. The original game, there was a lot more friction there. Like some of the monsters, like, there's 5 red wolves, 1 gray wolf, and he hits really hard. So you had to there was actually some extra tactics to how you approach those battles. And like speaking of quality of life, one thing that's not quite as obvious is like if you select all 4 of your party members to attack the same wolf and the first one kills the wolf, in the original NES, the rest of the 3 attacks would just hit dead air and miss. Whereas in the more recent versions, they would be reassigned to other monsters in the squad. So you actually did have to think a little more tactically and spread your attacks out rather than just spamming A and basically turning into an auto battler.
Yeah.
I don't know how it was for you, but basically in the Pixel Remaster, I did not do anything except for auto battle all attacks pretty much for every combat scenario until the final boss. I mean, there were some scenarios where I don't want to pick off these 9 enemies, which, like, that's quite a lot. Like, hitting 9 enemies at a time, like, that's a lot for any JRPG. But pretty much, like, I auto-battled everything, as long as you're improving the equipment on your party members.
Auto-optimize.
Whatever. Basically, the only time I actually stopped to do manual battle commands was the last boss fight. So significant difficulty spike at that point. Did you find that, Alex, in the version you played?
Yeah, pretty much. I think one of the big differences between my version and your version was that my version used MP, not the spell charge system. Because you, in the Pixel Remaster and the original, you had certain number of spell uses for level 1, certain number of spell uses level 2 for each of your spell casters.
It's basically the D&D system. Like, you have level 1 slots, level 2 slots, and once you use those slots, they're done. Like, you can use all your fireball spells, but then you have to use your level 2 spells instead.
Which is a little confusing on how the way the ether potion worked, because, you know, if it's just MP, you just regain a certain number of MP, everything costs a certain amount. Makes sense. It's like spending your pocket change. But it's sort of like spell slots of, like, what, 9 different tiers or something like that?
The ether would only give you 1 extra slot. You couldn't just refill. So that was one, again, in the original game, that was a big point of tension as to how far you could push those magic users. In theory, that does lead to more tactical interest of, like, having to use different tiers of spell. What I really meant was, like, you know, in play, it's like saving the rocket launcher in FPS. Basically, it meant I didn't use my spells at all until I got to the boss and then just spammed them.
Well, and that was my experience, was when I was running through a dungeon, I would use my level 1 spells because those didn't really matter. Like, I could use my level 1 spells on the elemental effectiveness of the right ones, right? Like, you're fighting a blue slime, you use a fire spell. But then when I got to the boss, I would use my high-level spells. I'm using the analogy of Final Fantasy III, because that was the first game I played that had that spell charge system. In Final Fantasy I, the Dawn of Souls remake, where I just had MP, I didn't touch my MP till I got to the boss. except for healing, of course, because I used the White Mage, Black Mage combo, exclusively because I don't like being cut out of high-level spells.
Yeah, that's a big, like, that's more than a quality of life improvement. That's a kind of a philosophical change, I think, and probably one of the bigger ones that separates old school Final Fantasy from the newer, basically newer, all JRPGs use the MP system, point-based system, which kind of is like de facto standard at this point. I don't know when in the Final Fantasy series they shifted it, but I guess we'll find out. Number 4. There you go.
It was fun getting to a new town. Oh, what new spells? Each town was basically had a new tier of spells, and you go, oh, what black magic spells can I unlock now? That was fun.
I think the magic system established here is maybe one of the most unique and interesting parts of the Final Fantasy series, and they established it right from the beginning. Basically, you don't have clerics and wizards and druids or things like that, you have white or black, and you have red in some cases. Some of the versions you have blue, but I believe in this game you only have access to white, black, or red. White being generally like healer protector, black being damage dealer, elemental damage, and then red being a little bit of melee, a little bit of both of those aforementioned areas. I chose white and black just for the kind of classic balance. I chose fighter, rogue, white, black. And another thing I really like about the magic system is that you only have like 3 slots per tier, but they generally offer you 4 or more spells per tier. So like you don't get to have the whole pantry at your disposal. Like that in itself is maybe one of the only real like kind of smart character customization decisions that you have to make in this game. But like it's enough. It's enough.
It's only one spell to miss in each tier. It's not a huge sacrifice, really. But I would have liked to lean a little more on that, perhaps.
That's a quarter of the options you don't get to use.
So. I did realize I didn't have haste in the final boss. That would have made it a lot different, I think.
Yeah, and eventually, like, there's a sort of like a weird, you know, this is a bit of a spoiler, but there's like a kind of a time skip moment where you get to like upgrade your character classes from like
swole.
Yeah, they get super saiyan essentially. So they upgrade from their original form to their
it's like final the adult form, Link versions.
And some character classes gain access to additional spells at that point. So you do get a little bit more flexibility there, but I thought that like that was just enough restriction to make, you know, you could play multiple times and try out a different selection of spells. But overall, like, these are pretty, like, linear games. If you know who to talk to get access to the MacGuffin, you know how to proceed. If you know where the airship is, you know where to go straight away. If you have a guide, this is just, like, bing, bing, bang, boom. Like, you're in and out really fast. I think it took me... I was taking my time, so I think I probably played for around 13 hours. How long did you guys play for?
I was also 13 hours. I looked up my save the other day and... Like, without following a guide too closely, like, just walking around doing everything, it was 13 hours for me from start to finishing the final boss.
About 10 or 11 for me. That was, like, just hitting auto-attack in most regards and, you know, breezing through it. I've heard about 20 hours quoted for the original NES version.
Yeah, and they're basically the only way, like, you kind of need to be a completionist is basically, like, did you get every corner of the dungeon? And did you open every chest, essentially?
Well, curiously, Dawn of Souls has some other stuff. I was curious if you played that, Alex.
I did a little bit. It was weird. It's like almost like a roguelike style where like you're supposed to go down like 10 floors and each floor is a randomly selected biome. And then you can fight a whole bunch of bosses from like later Final Fantasy games.
There's like 4 extra like post-game advanced dungeons is my understanding, right?
Yeah, pretty much. And like once you beat each of the elemental bosses is when they unlock each of those extra dungeons. I didn't go too far into it, but at least there's post-game interesting stuff to do.
Anecdotally, I did hear that those were quite large and involved dungeons that were quite, you know, a little more interesting layout than the original.
So that was just a feature for Dawn of Souls.
Yes. Most of the graphical changes in Dawn of Souls were actually from the Wondrous One, as we said. But what Dawn of Souls did add was like 4 brand new dungeons that aren't in the Pixel Remaster.
Yeah, let's talk about some of the maybe graphical changes a little bit, and maybe some other upgrades that we can consider beyond just the mechanics. Obviously, it's still pixel graphics. They did polish up a lot of stuff. It's not 8-bit anymore, obviously. It's at least somewhere between 16 and 32 for the Pixel Remaster. I thought it was pretty tasteful how they did the upgrades. It obviously looks different side by side, but it doesn't look so pressed through a sieve, like losing all personality. Like there's still some clever choices. There's some dithering around where like kind of the color transitions and the gradients. I understand that they brought back the original pixel artist from Final Fantasy I to basically consult and reinterpret all the character sprites from across the entire series, 1 through 6, so that they'd be a little bit more consistent. So I think there was some care and attention paid to carrying a little bit of that tradition forward of appreciation of pixel art. No, it's not the same, but it doesn't look so radically different like some of the newer 2D HD games that are coming out of Square Enix, like Dragon Quest III HD, or the new, I guess, what's that Elliot game or whatever for
Octopath Traveler.
Switch to Octopath Traveler, for sure. That sort of stuff. Obviously, the overworld looks great, like the shimmering water and some of the tiling looks obviously a little bit nicer and less kind of like sprite-based, strictly sprite-based as the original NES does. So what do you guys think of the improvements of your various versions?
I liked the sprite work on the Game Boy Advance version. I've looked at the Pixel Remaster graphics for Final Fantasy 1, and I'm not a big fan of the character sprites. They look really flat, in my opinion, especially when like juxtaposed on how gorgeous the enemy sprites are, and like the effects of the magic and the backgrounds. Like everything else about the Pixel Remaster looks so good. I feel like the character sprites are just so bland in comparison. Like I can see where they're drawing their inspirations from those original 1987 sprites, but I just feel like it doesn't quite jive with me. I'm not sure if that's because I have this nostalgia for my preferred 2004 version of Final Fantasy I sprites, but that's just my opinion, I guess.
Fair. It's hard to satisfy all audiences because like there's the technology of today, there's the screen technology of the today, and back on the NES times, basically all displays were CRTs.
Yeah.
So CRTs, different technology. Even if you rendered the exact same pixels, they would look different because there's a different amount of blending. There's a different amount of like alternating scan lines that you really don't get in some of the, you know, the retro emulation hardware and software we've been talking about. Actually has some options that you can kind of turn on effects to recreate some of that CRT styling. So I don't think this version let you sort of have a CRT effect, but I know that some retro game remasters do let you enable that.
I'm not particularly precious about trying to, you know, recap the original magic. We can never go home. You're never going to get the feeling of what it was like. I mean, to some extent, this Pixel Remaster probably does look like it felt to play this game on the NES back in the day. It did restore the sprite, largely the original sprites from the original game, but just use the new world map and background that, you know, beautifully illustrated, a little more lush and rich than the original NES version. But yeah, it's tricky. I can never entirely judge this game how it was when it originally came out and separate it from sort of nostalgia and 40 years separated, right?
Yeah, it's really hard. I will take your point that the monster art always looked more impressive than the character art, like always did. And it still continues to. Maybe because the sprite art, especially on the overworld, is quite piddly and small. And on the battles, they're maybe like twice the height, so they're like slightly higher res. But the monsters can often be like quite large.
Quite sprites. Dynamic poses, too.
That's right. And did you guys check out any of the kind of like optional art gallery stuff that was provided in some of the versions?
Well, I've looked up like Yoshitaka Amano's like artwork that I think the developers provided instruction to Amano, and then he provided back his style of like those ethereal, wonderful watercolors that he does. And then I think they took that to make the sprites in the game. I'm pretty sure that was the flow of it.
Yeah, I think that's pretty much what I've heard as well. And I think that's kind of what happened in cases like Dragon Quest as well with Akira Toriyama's artwork as well. You know, basically it's all manners of interpretation because like that technology was pretty darn limited. And I think in both cases, Final Fantasy I and Dragon Quest I, the monster art is pretty darn faithful to the concept art provided by the artist. In the case of Final Fantasy Pixel Remaster, there's a optional art gallery that they provide. So there's a bunch of that concept art you mentioned. Beautiful, like really lush, like Hollywood quality, like conceptual art of like vast landscapes and kind of epic scenarios that just like the pixel art just looks so sad in comparison next to. But the gallery of the, I don't know, maybe like 20, 30 original monster designs look pretty much spot on, even down to the poses. Every one of the enemies, the slimes, the sahagins, the giants, things like that, they're in the same poses that they are, that Yoshitaka Amano created. And it's pretty darn impressive. So they were able to pull it off even back then in the original days, and definitely now. Like, it looks great. It's well worth checking out that optional art gallery in Pixel Remaster. And they did a similar thing with the audio soundtrack as well. So this time around, the audio has been re-recorded by a symphony orchestra, I believe based out of Osaka in this case, for Pixel Remaster. They do provide audio kind of like a jukebox screen, where you can listen to the whole new soundtrack or the old soundtrack as well. So you can listen to the same tracks in both versions. And some of this music is just like absolutely like stunning. I think the underwater scenario where they take the little submarine down under the water to the land of mermaids or whatever was particularly captivating in the new orchestration and kind of really like transports you.
The battle theme goes really hard with like this metal guitar going off. Like, it's very simple pixel battle going on, and the music is cranked to 11.
Yeah, there's this music is so iconic for a reason. A lot of these themes that we're hearing in the later versions, you know, Final Fantasy 14, it all came from someplace, and a lot of it's coming from here. So that was a really appreciated feature as well. Not a lot aside from that, just primarily the art gallery, the music gallery, those were done pretty well. You know, the final ending movie or whatever is not that. It's just another scroll, just kind of like the starting scroll. Not a lot. I guess par for the course for console RPGs of the time.
I mean, for what it's worth, the opening scroll, there's actually like this opening cinematic, like panning over the world. I found that pretty effective. That was added, I think, in the Dawn of Souls. It wasn't in the original NES version, but I thought that was quite cool for this old game, sort of giving you a sense of the world and that you're about to explore.
The wind has stopped blowing. The earth is rotting. Yeah, it set the scene very well.
Yes.
Yeah, it showcased some of the landscapes that you might see, like the tower and the desert, you know, kind of evocative stuff. So that was pretty smart. Like some of the later pixel games, like, you know, 4, for instance. I must have started Final Fantasy 4 a dozen times and never finished it. But like the scene of the Mode 7 of the SNES, of the airships flying over the entire world and then landing on that little temple and they're attacking the wizards that are protecting the crystal. It's just kind of so cinematic and epic. Like, it just starts you right in the middle of the action. And I think the older RPGs didn't really have that. So maybe that intro cutscene was trying to make up for that fact. Very cool. So Final Fantasy 1, I mean, pretty simple. Were you surprised by anything when you played this game? Did you have some preconceptions going in or memories going in that the newer version surprised you or anything? Maybe you, Alex?
I didn't have very many preconceptions because my experience with 1 was like playing with it on my buddy's older brother's computer when I was 8 type of thing for 3.5 seconds before he kicked me out of his room. I think what surprised me was learning that the game was made by 5 people, like the credits had 5 people on it. Like, and seeing some of the things that would become series staples was interesting, like the town of Mysidia, which was like a magic town, and a few of those monsters, and just like laying the bedrock of so many games that I then loved, seeing where those inspirations were obviously drawn from was really, really fun for me to discover.
That's awesome.
Yeah, this is a pretty simple template. It is hard to go back, and there's not a lot of depth here, obviously. It is more interesting as a historical artifact. To me, I kind of wish I just played the NES version, to be honest, because I feel like a lot of these quality of life features just... It feels a little bit like an ice sculpture, where like it has the same general shape, but without those points of friction, there's just nothing to hold on to. Like, you can't really see the details. And not to say that I wished I did 20 hours of grinding, but I think just to get a better sense of what it felt like at the time with the pacing and the friction and the tactics, perhaps. It is hard. Like, those quality of life features are awfully, like, easy. It just, you sort of just slide in and just play. The game always plays itself at this point. I don't know that it's a good representation of what the game was like at the time, though.
Yeah, I guess I'm of a little bit different opinion of you than that, Daniel, about remakes. Like, I don't know about you, but some listeners know that I did some theater in the past, and, you know, coming from theater background, you are used to a lot of, like, reinterpretation. So whether it's stage theater, operas, musicals, Shakespeare, you do a lot of different interpretations of Shakespeare, for instance. Your countryman, Daniel, Baz Luhrmann, did a modern version of Romeo and Juliet that was pretty controversial at the time because it had guns, it had sex, it had drugs. It was very kind of different from the original concept. But nowadays, you know, that film is shown in high schools too, because it connects people with the source material in about how kind of controversial and shocking that subject matter was, much more than, like, say, the old crusty 1960s even staged film version of Romeo and Juliet that was actually a little bit controversial even then in the 1960s. So, like, we reinterpret these pieces over and over again. Like, every year there's a different version of La Boheme or Madama Butterfly in the Vancouver Opera. So and they do a different setting, they do different costumes, they update it, set it in different periods in history. And these different versions, they're not meant to be authentic, right? They're not meant to be authentic except anything but to the spirit of the source material. And I think that, you know, these modern versions, they help people get into, they help people latch onto maybe subject matter that is a little bit harder to understand from a modern viewpoint. You know, let's just admit it, you know, old games is old. They're like a little harder to
inaccessible get into. without a manual, like, especially
just like old English is hard to understand from a modern English standpoint. So I really support a lot of these modern versions, and, you know, probably the best way to get a perspective is to just play multiple versions. You know, play the GBA version, play the NES version, play the PS1 version or the Pixel Remaster version, then you get a little bit of a spread. But, like, the thing that's great about the game is, like, the scenarios. Those don't change, like, the ideas, just, like, the concepts. And, you know, what's not great is grinding. Like, like, I don't need grinding to make me feel, like, more authentic. Like, that the grinding was just an artifact of making a game made by five people last 20, 40, summer. 30, 40 hours. Exactly. Yeah. They didn't want you to finish it right away like you could if you had a guide. Yeah, so I thought that was pretty enjoyable. Yeah, I thought the Pixel Remaster is great, but, you know, I played it in other versions and enjoyed it as well. This series, like, it's accessible in a lot of different ways, so I think that's a good thing overall.
Yeah. So, I mean, looking forward, Alex, I'm most curious in how this series evolves over time. Do you have any insights to, like, what's next going into Final Fantasy II?
Oh, man, Final Fantasy II is weird. It's kind of like, if you know Zelda, Zelda 2, The Adventures of Link, was weird. Final Fantasy II changed so much. Like, kind of everything we talked about, any gripe you may have had, is kind of what they changed in Final Fantasy II, where, like, the characters all have names. The characterization of them is still pretty bland, but they're all the characters are now named. Anyone can wield any weapon or spell, and the more you use those things, the better they get with that thing.
It's kind of like Elder Scrolls logic, isn't it?
Yeah. But it doesn't quite play extremely well. Again, like, this is now a game from 1988. Like, yeah, my big gripe with Final Fantasy II was just the story, actually, and how it didn't mesh with the gameplay. Like, there was a dissonance there. Basically, to spoil a 35-year-old game, you spend the whole game looking for the spell Ultima, because the Empire is going to come and destroy you with their ultimate might. So you need to find the spell Ultima, and, like, you spend the whole game looking for the spell. Like, party members die, you're looking for the spell, and you finally get it. You're like, yes, I have Ultima, and you add it to your character, and it's Ultima level 1. By this point, all your other spells, like level 10, and it does as much damage as like a basic fireball. You're like, this is useless to me. And then you just continue on with your plight and you beat the Empire. Like, it's like, what was the point of most of this game? But it does kind of reflect Final Fantasy and Square's ability and willingness to change. Like, they changed so much about 2, and then again into 3 they kind of made it a blend of 1 and 2, and then 4 was its own thing entirely, and 5, 6, 7, 8, everyone I've played has been quite different, which I think is quite unlike the Dragon Quest series, where you can see a pretty strong genetic through line for each of those games. Final Fantasy is constantly changing and reimagining, which probably makes something like, you know, when Final Fantasy 16 comes out, old fans are like, well, this is not the Final Fantasy that I grew up with, you know?
Yeah, that's fair. I think Dragon Quest have tried some, like, narrative things, especially in, like, the kind of the 5, 6, 7 area to shake things up, even all the way up until 9. I think you play as, like, a dead angel or something in that one. But mechanically, they pretty keep it pretty tight to the vest, system-wise, in the Dragon Quest series. I failed to mention that the one thing that surprised me about Final Fantasy 1 is that there were little hints at a little bit of sci-fi. A little bit more. I mean, I didn't remember that at all from when I played it. And it made me kind of smile that Final Fantasy has always had one foot in fantasy camp and one foot in the science fiction camp. So it's a true science fantasy. And they established it right at the beginning.
Well, speaking of sci-fi, I mean, ultimately, having now played the first Final Fantasy and the first Phantasy Star, I think the Phantasy Star series definitely grabbed me as, like, more engaging and innovative and immersive an experience, especially that first one. And, I mean, I definitely will be continuing in Final Fantasy, but if you've been following me on Blue Sky, you will have seen that I just started playing Phantasy Star 2, and it also, like, really changes things up. That first person, like, wizardry dungeon exploration system is gone.
Yep, that's right. Phantasy Star has always attracted me. It's got named characters. It's got lush 16-bit graphics.
There's a lot of story in the opening of Phantasy Star 2. I was quite surprised.
Yeah, dialogue, character personalization, like characters die, characters morph into different forms. It had a lot of things right out of the bat, and I haven't played the later games, so I'm glad that those exist for me to play a little bit more of.
Excellent.
And so we'll be happily following your series, Alex, at Meeple and the Moose. And I hope you get to reach to the end, to Final Fantasy 12 of the older Final Fantasy games, because 12 is one of my faves. Controversial choice.
12 is very good. I fell off it at some point, but I did really enjoy it.
cool.
And obviously we've now got Final Fantasy Tactics, the Ivalice Chronicles. It just came out last week. I've been playing that. I'll have thoughts somewhere down the road.
Yep, the second remake of Final Fantasy Tactics. Right. We'll have to have you back if we talk about that game in full length. And I want to talk a little bit about Tactics Advance and A2 as well.
Please do.
Cool. We went a little long. Do you think we have time to talk about dessert? Or maybe we could just talk about yours, Alex?
Yeah, I'll save mine for next week.
Yeah, I'll save mine as well. Alex, you want to tell us about a little off-topic subject?
Yeah, I was going to talk about Tokyo Noir, because Mark talked about Tokyo Vice a couple weeks ago. But I figured since we're into October, I want to present The September House by Carissa Orlando. Daniel, I know you and your wife cram horror movies in October, but this is a book, so a little bit different. And much like your last guest, I actually generally abhor all things horror, but this book is worth taking a look at. Basically, the story is that Margaret and Hal have bought the house of their dreams. You know, their daughter has just moved out, and they've bought this house. It's this big, old, beautiful Victorian-style house nestled in the woods, nice and secluded. They get a really good deal on the price, too.
What could go wrong?
Think happy thoughts. things go sideways when a series of poltergeists make their presence known to Margaret and Hal. Like, there's a housekeeper with an axe wound, but she's a great cook. Another ghost screams like a banshee if you try to use the fireplace, and so on and so forth. And if Margaret or Hal happen to touch these ghosts, their minds are filled with the visions and memories of their demise. Well, Margaret will be damned if these pesky ghosts ruin her own home. She's bound and determined to live with them, to coexist peacefully. You just need to learn to follow the rules, and everyone can live, or not live, happily together. And basically that's the setting for this ghost story. It's just this, I hate using the term, but it's a cozy horror where like, what really made this book magical was I listened to it as an audiobook, and the narrator and the words of the book, it just describes like all these grotesque and terrible scenes with utter mundanity. Like it is just she's the most blasé attitude. She's like, no, it's fine. It's just an axe wound. It. Yeah, it's like, it's totally normal. You just follow the rules and it'll be fine. Everyone just fits in their place. It's okay. It was a really funny book. I laughed a lot. And not because it's like slapstick or crazy, but because the dark comedy is interwoven beautifully with just the prose. You know, the main character is deadpan and bored and describing the events as if they're just bringing tea up to the table. So just for the sake of the protagonist and for a horror book for people who don't generally like horror, I think it's a great read.
If you want to get some October spooky vibes without actually being scared, perhaps.
Yeah,
it's a good choice.
Yeah, that's funny. It sounds almost like a sitcom more than the horror story. And isn't there like a comedy series about a couple living in a house with ghosts? That's,
is it called Ghosts?
It's I know that there's a British production and yeah, then an American version.
There's a few of them. Yeah.
So maybe it's based on this book.
I did Google September House movie and show and nothing came up, but I'm also not very well attuned to the horror film genre.
That's too good of a premise to pass up. So that sounds like a lot of fun. Thanks for bringing those to our attention, Alex.
Excellent. Well, thanks for that, and thanks for joining us, Alex. Where can people find you on the internet?
I'm everywhere, just as meepleandthemoose.com. Blue Sky. I have a YouTube account where I post stupid memes. And my blog is the main place to reach me at. It's just meepleandthemoose.com.
Excellent. Well, we'll post that link in the show notes.
Very good. All right. Well, thank you so much for being on the show again. I guess we'll do our regular outro and sign off.
Yeah. Well, if you have any thoughts or questions or comments, what your favorite Final Fantasy game is, you can contact us at omnigamersclub@gmail.com or at our website, omnigamers.club.
That's right. You can watch our videos on YouTube. We post those up every week when the new episodes go out. If you're interested in catching up on our older episodes, the earliest ones are only in audio form, so go check them out on a podcatcher of your choosing. We'd love to hear your feedback in any form on those platforms. You can email us. There's a form on the website, or just reach out at omnigamersclub@gmail.com, like Daniel said. You know, it's how, you know, we've gotten in close connection with people, listeners like Alex, and social media as well. We love to hear comments there. You know, we want this to be a discussion with fellow game, old game lovers. So we're happy to hear what your thoughts are.
Okay, well, thanks for joining us. Thanks for listening, everyone. And thank you, Alex. Remember to have a balanced diet of games.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye.